man in Texas who was a faithful church member in a fundamental Bible-believing church was laid off from an aircraft company where he had been employed as a line laborer for 4 years. After being laid off, he did not pursue further employment, but simply worked on cars in his driveway and mowed lawns for a living. He was willing to do this because it allowed him to be involved in ministry at his church, as well as to be free to go on mission trips, attend meetings with his pastor, and so on. After a few months of enjoying that type of a different sort of a lifestyle, another major aeronautical corporation sent this man a letter offering him a position of employment. He did not respond. He was content with his present position, his opportunity to minister at his church, the flexibility, he was paying his bills, he was happy. But the letter was followed by a phone call and eventually a visit to his home by top-ranking officials in that aeronautical corporation. They wanted him to work as the head of one of their quality control engineering departments. He explained to them that he didn't have a degree in that field. He explained to them that he had honestly very little experience in that area. But they looked at him and told him that they had been in conversation with his previous employer. Because of the recommendation from the previous employer, they were sure he was their man. They were not concerned about his degree or his experience. After prayer and counsel, he decided he would take the position with the company. This young, under-experienced, virtually no degrees man had just a little bit of education past high school, that was it, was about to become the head of a group of over 20 professional engineers who everyone had at least a minimum of a master's degree and at least 20 years experience in their fields of work. Some of them had actually been with the company longer than this young man had been alive. In fact, he was told by the people who hired him to not let the people working underneath him know how little experience and how little education he had. They said, "We know you're our man. Don't let them know that, but we want you to take this responsibility in this department over." Realizing that he had quite a task ahead of him, he sought the counsel of his pastor as to how he might be able to pull that group of men together. They had not been very productive like the company wanted up to that point. There were real problems with that department, and he knew, the company knew there was a lot of potential. They wanted to get the job done, and this man about to walk into an area where he felt very somewhat incompetent, went to his pastor to ask how he could do what he needed to do with this group of people in this department, in this corporation, in order to get the job done that was needed to be done. Now, I want to speak to you tonight on the subject, understanding biblical leadership. And I want to begin by saying to you, first of all, that there is a great need for proper biblical leadership. I want to say it again, let it soak in. I said there is a great need for proper biblical leadership. I suppose that the story I'm about to tell, it's admittedly a fictitious story, and yet I'm sure it must have happened once or perhaps many times in the days of the Old West. A stagecoach with his precious cargo of people was traveling from one western town to another. The driver and his partner were visibly anxious because the area where they were traveling was known for its bandits. Suddenly there was the crack of gunfire mixed with the sound of wagon creaks and horses' hooves, and with ruthless abandon, thieves shot and killed the drivers, took the money box, robbed the passengers. And then with sadistic glee, they loaded the passengers back into the stagecoach and with no driver topside, frightened the horses into a wild gallop. with a stagecoach careening wildly out of control down a mountainside towards seemingly certain death, one brave man pulled himself out of the coach and made the perilous climb up the outside of the stagecoach toward the driver's seat. To the incredible relief of his family and the other passengers, this father took the reins of the runaway stagecoach in hand and brought the stagecoach to a safe halt just moments away from what appeared to be a sure death crashing down the mountainside. God created three great organizations: the family, the church, and the state or the nation. Any one of those three or any other organization at any time may find itself running wildly out of control until someone takes the reins of leadership and brings it back into control. I've seen homes that look like that runaway stagecoach heading wildly but surely toward destruction. Churches are like that sometimes. I visited with a man in the hospital yesterday who told me about being saved and baptized in a church near here 50 years ago in a revival meeting, a fundamental Bible-believing church at the time. He said that the very next night, he went back to the next night of the revival meeting, and there was a fight in the church, and the police had to be called. He left and joined another church that was not really a Bible-preaching church, and he and his wife have spent the last 50 years of their life serving in the other church because there was a weakness in the church where he had just been saved and baptized. Our society, if we don't return to God and the principles of God's Word, may well run off the road and wind up in the heap of other fallen nations in the valley below. It has happened to other nations. We would be foolish and proud to say it could never happen to America. Someone must take the reins of leadership in an organization. The question is, how? What is the proper biblical way for someone to take leadership in an organization? There are three possible ways to take the reins of leadership in any organization, but only one of those is God's way. Only one will truly bring peace to a dangerous situation. It is not that the other types of leadership won't work, but they won't work properly and they won't work long range. I've seen countries that over a period of time shifted back and forth between different styles of leadership. I've seen fathers and husbands who struggled and shifted back and forth trying to understand what style of leadership they were supposed to use in relation to their families. Unless and until the country or the father or the pastor or the business owner or the leader in whatever organization figures out God's ordained style of leadership, things will not go well and followers will have trouble following and respecting their leaders. So I said, first of all, there's a great need for proper biblical leadership. I want to say, secondly, I hope to use this as a challenge to you that godly Christians should aspire to positions of leadership. I want you to think about that. I'm going to give you strong Bible proof for that statement, but godly Christians really should aspire to positions of leadership. It is not wrong to want to be a leader. It is wrong to be the wrong kind of a leader. It is also wrong, now think about this statement, I won't repeat it again, but it is really a key thought. It is wrong to use the right kind of leadership, which I'll be telling you toward the end of the message. It is wrong to use the right kind of leadership to lead people to go the wrong way. There have been many times in history, we've seen it even in the United States of America, where a person would use God's kind of leadership, the Bible kind of leadership, and use it to deceive people, to lead people the wrong way. Now, it is also wrong to just want to have power or want to be a big shot. There are folks who just want to have position. They want to have power. They just want to be a big shot. In the book of Judges, Abimelech was like that. Power may be perilous to the person who holds it. Whatever power he or she may have. It is also wrong to want a position just so you can be popular. There are folks who just want a position because there's something about they love to hear their name called or something like that. Now, I'm saying that godly Christians should aspire to positions of leadership. Virtually everyone here at some time or other finds himself in a position of leadership. I have 2 5-year-old grandsons in 2 different families. I have seen them both at times leading their younger brothers and sisters. I've also noticed that their younger siblings respond better when they use the proper biblical style of leadership. It's true. Even a 5-year-old, you children here, listen to me. If you use the, if you get what I'm preaching tonight, and I think it'll be simple enough if you listen carefully that you can get it. If you use the proper style of leadership with younger brothers and sisters, then they are far more likely to respect you, love you, and follow you. You would create a lot more peace in your home, in your family. In the Bible, there were fathers, patriarchs, kings, priests, prophets, apostles, pastors, teachers, evangelists, and so on. In fact, whenever God wanted a job done, He would first look for a man to do it. Incidentally, this is not a negative reflection on the talents or capabilities of ladies, nor is it a reason for men to become haughty or proud. But it's true, if you look through the Bible, it was almost always a man that God sought for key positions of leadership. There's a passage where God says, I sought for a man to stand in the gap. When God wanted to start the human race, He began with a man and then gave Adam a helper to stand by him and encourage him. When God wanted to start all over again because of the wickedness of man, God chose Noah. Noah was both a boat builder and a preacher. But his biggest asset was that he was the leader of his family. When God wanted a group of people for Himself, He called Abraham. When God wanted to spare those people from destruction, He chose Joseph. Put him down in Egypt and let him spare the people by the things that he did there for those years. When God wanted to lead those people out of the bondage of Egypt, God called Moses at the burning bush. When God wanted those people to conquer the land of Canaan, He called Joshua. When God wanted deliverers for His people, He called Gideon and Samson and Samuel and others to be judges. God called prophets, men like Elijah and Elisha and Isaiah and even Jonah, who was somewhat a reluctant prophet. When God sought him a man after His own heart, He had Samuel anoint David and made David the king over His people Israel. When God wanted a forerunner for His son, He called John the Baptist. When God needed a Savior, He sent His Son, the Lord Jesus. When God wanted leaders for His new church, He had Jesus call disciples. When God wanted a preacher to the Gentiles, He sent a light from heaven and called Saul, who became the mighty missionary evangelist, the Apostle Paul. In 1 Timothy 3:1, we read, if a man desire the office of bishop, he desireth a good work. Notice that word, desire. It means stretch oneself out to grasp something, to reach after. If a man desire, if he stretches himself after, if he reaches after this, if a man desires and wants this, then he desires a good work. Godly Christians should aspire to positions of leadership. I believe God calls men. I also believe it's all right if you say, God, I'd love to do something for you. It's amazing how God takes volunteers. One reason our world is in the mess it's in is because not enough godly young men have said, I want to be a leader for God. Just in the last few days, one of our young men wisely observed to me this statement, Pastor Davis, most people in the world are followers who are looking for leaders. Remember that Isaiah the prophet in chapter 6, verse 8 said, also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send? And who will go for us? Then said I, here am I, send me. Here am I. Send me. A volunteer. Somebody aspiring. Godly Christian aspiring to leadership. Now, leadership has its downside. Leadership is difficult. Leadership is stressful. If you're in a position of leadership, you know that what I'm telling you is true. A leader often, surprisingly to some followers, a leader often feels lonely. A leader feels pressure, sometimes enormous pressure. A leader gets the blame when he should and at times when he shouldn't. On the other hand, leaders have a sense of accomplishment that you don't have if you don't aspire to leadership. Leaders are often rewarded in a number of different ways for assuming the responsibilities of leadership. A while back, I was talking to a young man and I said to him, God has given you leadership abilities and wants you to be a leader for Him. He said, but Davis, I'm not sure I want to be a leader. And I don't think I want people following me. I said, you need to change that. God gave you leadership ability because He wanted you to be a leader. Christians should aspire to positions of leadership. Young men listening to me here tonight, you should aspire to positions of leadership. What are the three types of leadership seen in the Bible? First of all, is sympathy leadership. Sympathy leadership. What is that? It's where a man tries to get others to feel sorry for him and then uses that sympathy as a motivation to get others to follow him and do what he wants. You can see this illustrated in the Bible. Few men had the potential for greatness that did the man named Saul. When you first meet Saul in 1 Samuel 9, you are immediately impressed with him. He was God's choice to be the first king of Israel. He was humble and unpretentious. He had great leadership ability. He was a fearless soldier. He was a great public speaker. Physically, he was handsome and tall and athletic and extremely talented. That was Saul. But in 1 Samuel chapter 15, Saul let rebellion and disobedience creep into his life. He offered sacrifice without waiting on Samuel, and it was disobedience and rebellion against God. In chapter 17, he was the commander of the armies of Israel as they faced the Philistine army. That is the chapter where Goliath issued his challenge to the people of God, send someone to come and fight me, and if... He defeats me, then we will serve you, and vice versa. Saul didn't take the challenge. But a little known fellow by the name of David did. And you know the story how Goliath was defeated. David was given a position of leadership in the army and excelled at it. And Saul became ridiculously, absurdly jealous. In 1 Samuel 18:8 we read, and Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed unto David 10,000, and to me they've ascribed but thousands. David 10,000, me just thousands. They're praising David more than me. What can he have more but the kingdom? That was the beginning of the end for Saul. He was already falling into the sympathy trap. You can hear it in that verse. And as he went through these experiences, he began to change and shift in his style of leadership. Because he got away from God, he also got away from the way God ordained that a leader should lead. When he shifted his style of leadership, he loosened his grip on the reins of the kingdom. Saul was headed for disaster, and so were all his army and people with him. The shift in leadership style was the beginning of the end for Saul. You study through the passages there in Samuel, you'll find out that he was becoming more and more consumed, not with serving God's people as their king, but simply with preserving his own position. Is everybody still listening? Say amen. It is not enough for the leader in any organization to simply want to hold on to the reins. That's true whether it's the father in the home, leader in the church, a representative in government, a teacher in a school, the manager of a business. It is not enough to say, I'm the pastor here and you got to listen to me. Or, I'm the father here and you got to listen to me. Or, I'm the mayor here, you got to listen to me. Or whoever it might be. In 1 Samuel chapter 19, Saul tried to kill David with a javelin. His motivation? Nothing more than insane jealousy toward David, because David was becoming popular without even trying. He was just doing the right things. In chapter 21, David was running for his life from Saul. Saul trying to kill him. Every which way he turned, David's life is at stake because Saul wants to kill him. David came to Nob and talked to Ahimelech the priest. They needed some provisions, and Ahimelech the priest gave David bread and a sword, the sword of Goliath, in fact. In 1 Samuel 21, verse 7, it says, "Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, and his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chiefest of the herdmen that belonged to Saul. After David left there, Saul came in and found out that David had been there. The priest didn't even know that Saul had a problem with David, apparently. But Saul became very upset with the priest. In 1 Samuel 22:8, he said, "All of you have conspired against me, and there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse, and there is none of you that is sorry for me." Did you hear the whine in that phrase? "There is none of you that is sorry for me." Now, you might expect that out of a child, but out of a king? The king of the nation of Israel? The king of God's chosen people? I want to tell you, it just doesn't fit. Somebody say amen. Sympathy leadership is childish. Not only does it not fit with God's king, it also doesn't fit with any of God's people in leadership. Does that stop a man from being able to lead? No. But it perverts his thinking and causes him to make horrible decisions. Before that chapter ends, Saul has ordered, listen to this, Saul has ordered and overseen the murder, not only of 85 of God's priests, he has also overseen and the murder of the men, women, children, babies, and animals in the whole city of Nob, and only one man escaped with his life to tell David what happened. It's possible for anyone to fall into the trap of the sympathy syndrome. In a different area, in one of a different Bible story, in one of his songs, Ron Hamilton calls this the poochy lip disease. You ever hear that song? I like it. The story behind the poochy lip disease is found in 1 Kings 21. Ahab, the mighty king of Israel, asked Naboth to sell him Naboth's vineyard. It was right next door to the palace. Ahab offered Naboth either money or a better piece of land for it. Naboth rightly understood that his land was a special inheritance from his ancestors, which he was not supposed to sell. Ahab's response was immature, childish, and totally unbecoming to the position of a mighty king. When Naboth refused to sell, Ahab, is everybody still listening? Ahab went to his bedroom, crawled up on his bed, turned his face to the wall, and pouted and whined and cried. Listen to the words of the song, "The Poochy Lip Disease." King Ahab went a-walking in royal garments grand and saw a lovely vineyard while gazing o'er the land. He said, "I've got to have it. I always get my way." But when he could not get it, he pouted all the day. Do you know even a child can't get by with this? If you're going to play and use my bat and ball and glove, then you have to play according to my rules. A little while later, they're whining to mommy, "They don't want to play with me, Mommy." There may be times when a mother should give sympathy to a child. Are you listening? This is not one of those times. Mothers who give sympathy to sons in situations like this turn their sons into sniveling wimps. And mothers who give sympathy to daughters in situations like this turn them into spoiled brats. Now, if you remember nothing else about this point, remember the next five words, please. I'm going to have them say them with me in just a moment. Poochy lippers make poor leaders. Would everybody say that, please? Poochy lippers make poor leaders. Everybody, one more time, all together. Poochy lippers make poor leaders. When you stick up, nobody wants to listen. I've seen guys who got married and destroyed their marriage like that.
Well, you just didn't come home and you said you were going to, honey. And
she just gets tired of following that. And sometimes men do that and also become violent with it. Why was Jezebel in control while Ahab was king? You know he was. She was. Because her husband was a sympathy leader. That's why. Sympathy leaders cannot grab tight hold of the reins of leadership, so somebody has to. And it happened that wicked Jezebel was where she could grab the reins, and she did. When the one in authority defaults on his leadership and a wicked person takes control, the result may be worse than if the wagon were allowed to just run without a driver for a while. For Israel, it meant they fell into all kinds of false worship of Baal because Jezebel led them into that. Now, let me give you a principle of life that is illustrated in the Bible that, as far as I know, is always true. I really thought on this. I thought long on this. If you can find any exceptions to the principle I'm about to give you, I wish you'd tell me what they are, because I can't think of any exceptions to the following principle. I thought of something that I thought might be exceptions, and then I realized, no, they're not exceptions. Listen to it. This is the principle. I don't know of any exceptions. The giving of sympathy is not wrong. The seeking of sympathy is always wrong. Say it with me, would you please? The giving of sympathy is not wrong. The seeking of sympathy is always wrong. Sympathy is like a gift that you give to someone. As long as it's a gift, it's a beautiful thing. There are many times when we ought to give sympathy. If someone's lost a loved one, we ought to give them sympathy. If someone's going through a great trial, they may need and deserve our sympathy. Job in the Old Testament certainly needed and deserved and should have received some sympathy from Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Elihu, but he didn't get it. As long as sympathy is a gift, it's a beautiful thing. But the moment it is required by the other person, then it loses the beauty of a gift. There are certain phrases that sympathy seekers often use. Listen to these phrases. Make sure you don't let the words or the spirit of them get into your life. You don't love me as much as you love them. If you love me, you wouldn't treat me like that. I'm saying nobody should ever use these phrases. You treat her better than you treat me. You gave him more than you gave me. You don't care about me. You don't spend as much time with me as you do them. It's the same whine that was in the voice of Saul when he said, "None of you feel sorry for me." Sympathy leaders, get this, sympathy leaders create the exact opposite in followers from what they mean to create. They mean for followers to accept them. Instead, they cause followers to reject them. Even pastors sometimes fall into the childishness of sympathy leadership. When a pastor says, "Some of y'all don't really appreciate me as your pastor," and the folks in the congregation are thinking, "You're making it even harder to appreciate you, pastor." Here's another phrase. And there's a lot more I could use here if I had time. The problem, the phrase pastors use sometimes, the problems are just so great, I don't think I can keep going much longer. Sympathy leadership. Sometimes a church will get in financial trouble and the pastor will get up and say something like this, "Folks, the bills are piling up. I just don't know what we're going to do. And the people are thinking, well, if it's that bad, maybe we better bail out while we can." He actually worsens his own problem. Here's another one. This statement's about as bad as it gets. Folks, if you just knew how bad things really are. A pastor who says something like that, or a father, or a leader in any organization who says something like that, what he doesn't realize. And you know, there's a balance there. Certainly there are times when there are problems that have to be shared with folks, or there are problems that have to be prepared for. A wise man foresees evil and hides himself, prudent man, and so on. But the balance is that you keep the whine out of the voice. You don't do it seeking for sympathy. Here's one. Folks, if you just knew, maybe I already gave you this, if you just knew how bad things really are. A very wise leader in our day, one of the strongest preachers in our day, said this. Very wise statement. Listen, leadership is the ability to hide your panic from others. Fathers, your children need to know. Sure, there might be times you share problems with them, but your children need to know Daddy's in control. I said that sympathy leadership is childish. Have you ever heard children say something like this? His is bigger than mine. You let him get by with that. You wouldn't let me get by with that. I'd love to help. Ooh, I'd love to help somebody right here. Is everybody still awake? I'd love to help some parent or grandparent right here. Grandmother, don't fuss at your children and grandchildren by saying things to them like this. You don't ever come to see me. You always go and see the other grandparents. You don't ever come to see me. You don't love me as much as you love them. Now look. You know, all that does is cause people not to want to come to see you. Instead, see, the seeking of sympathy is always wrong. If you say to them instead, you know what? I know y'all have your own family. I know how busy you are. I am always amazed and thrilled that you would take time to come and see me. That is such a blessing. It's just so wonderful to spend time with you. And I know it might be a long time for you. You know what will happen? The long times won't be as long. Your praise will motivate them to want to come more often. Get rid, I'm talking to everybody here tonight, in any area of life, get rid of sympathy. Children, listen to me. Get rid of sympathy-motivated expectations and replace them with a humble spirit of gratefulness for whatever you got. Young people, listen to me. Your parents, you say, well, so-and-so's parents, they let them do that. Now, that's really going to motivate your parents, isn't it? Why don't you say, you know, I am so thrilled, Dad, with what you let me do here and where you let me go there. And I'm just thankful for that. I'd love to go there. Dad, can I? Well, if I can, it's all right. Hey, you know what that does? If your dad turns you down, he'll walk away saying, maybe I better think about this again. Because he will appreciate your grateful spirit and your praise, and your grateful spirit will motivate him to let you do whatever he can let you do. And with a spirit like that, he will also feel like he can trust you more. Sympathy. Sympathy leadership produces feelings of insecurity in followers instead of security. The leader is viewed as haughty and weak instead of humble and meek. Think of this in the business world all around you. There's nobody here who goes to a restaurant to eat because you feel sorry for the poor people who are having trouble making their restaurant survive. If you go to a restaurant to eat, talk to me now, am I telling you the truth? You go there to be served. You take away the service and everybody would stay home. The food itself is service. Even if you don't have a waiter coming to your table or a waitress coming to your table, it's immaterial. The reason you went to the restaurant is because somebody's going to fix the food for you. The food itself involves service, and the service involves service. And you give, you serve. Bus workers, listen to me. People do not ride a bus because they feel sorry for the bus captain. I don't think I can stand to continue to be a bus captain if I can't get a few more riders on my bus. Well, you probably won't be a bus captain very long, because the riders sense that. Sunday school teachers. People don't come to a Sunday school class because they feel sorry for the Sunday school teacher. Well, I've been teaching this class for 2 years and it hasn't grown and y'all just won't listen to me. No, you're about to lose it. When people get on your bus, come into your Sunday school class, serve them. Serve them praise. Serve them gratitude. Serve them a well-organized program or lesson. Serve them control. They need control. Sympathy leadership's the wrong kind of leadership. Second type of leadership pictured in the Bible is dictatorial leadership. Now, follow this thought. Sympathy leadership is childish. Dictatorial leadership is caustic. It's like acid. It's burning. It's destructive. The Bible is full of examples of this. I won't even begin to scratch the surface of the number of stories I'll tell you. I'll just use a few key ones. In Daniel chapter 3, without any judge or jury, Nebuchadnezzar angrily sentenced Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to the burning fiery furnace because they would not bow before his massive golden image. Incidentally, to remind you again that only God can handle anger. Most dictators are very angry men. A man who is a dictator or thinks of himself that way may too easily assume the prerogatives of God himself. And no man can ever be God. No one should ever obey any man to the point that it would cause him to directly disobey God. I thank God for the patience of the people of this church over the years toward me as your pastor. I'm so glad you've loved me and followed me until God could teach me some of these truths. I'm also grateful for your understanding and vision for the need to share these truths with other pastors and churches and Christians. I remember many years ago making the statement from the pulpit here. This was the statement. I'm not a dictator, but I'm the closest thing to it around here. Some of y'all, lots of y'all remember me. How many of y'all remember me making that statement? You're kind, but there's more than that. Recently, I was told by a pastor in another country that the concept is all over that country among Bible-believing pastors and churches that a pastor is supposed to be a benevolent dictator. He said, this is what is spread all over our country. You know what my answer to that is? No. Dictatorship is wrong. Period. Many times throughout my life, listen to this. Don't miss this. Don't miss this. Listen. Somebody's awake, poke them, tell them to wake up. Or if they're awake, poke them, tell them to get more awake. If they're asleep, tell them to wake up. All right. Many times throughout my life, I've heard discussion and debate about what is the proper form of government for a church. Is it a democracy? Is it an autocracy? Is it a theocracy? Do you know what I believe is the best answer to that question? I never discovered this while I was studying this topic. I believe the best answer to that question is this. The question itself is wrong and misleading. When you have a flawed question, you can't give a good answer to it. Let me tell you a better question that focuses it more on God's perspective. The better question would be this. What style of leadership should a leader in a church use? Not what type of government does the church have, that's fine. But more focused biblically is what style of leadership should a church leader use? If you ask that question and then properly answer it, then the other question, frankly, barely even matters. Think about it. There were good and bad kings in the Bible. And it wasn't because of the form of government as much as it was the king's own style of leadership. His own character, his own righteousness, his own walk with God, and growing out of that, the style of leadership that he used. There are several different types of government pictured throughout the Bible. That's the reason you try to nail down God's preference for a certain style of government. You have all kinds of problems nailing it down. But the most important thing was not the style of government, but who the leader was and what style of leadership he exercised. Jesus was God Himself. He had every right to exercise dictatorial authority. He never did. Dictatorial leadership's always wrong. Notice what Jesus said in Luke 22, 25 to 27. The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them. Catch that. Gentile kings, where God's law was not even a part of their culture. He went on, Jesus said, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. What's that? That's the king or whoever it was saying, I'm the big benefactor. You need me. You can't get along without me. Dictatorial leadership is always wrong. Notice King Herod talking to the wise men about the birth of Jesus and then ordering the death of all the babies. A dictator or a man with that mindset will do just about anything to hold on to his position and his power. Look at Ahasuerus in the book of Esther ordering the death of all the Jews. Look at Abimelech in Judges chapter 9 murdering 70 of his brothers on one stone so that he would have no competition and no rivals for his position as king. A dictator wants what he wants when he wants it, and there's no reasoning with him. Dictators are often harsh, cruel, and self-serving, but the failure of dictatorship as a style of leadership can be seen 1,000 times over in history. Look at Ceausescu in Romania. When we were over in Romania, we were in the city of Brasov, and we saw on the sides of the building there the pock marks where the guns had led during the revolution, when Ceausescu a few years ago was overthrown, where the fight broke out and where the guns marked up the walls. It was still very clear when we were there. Look at Hitler in Germany. Look at Mussolini in Italy. Look at Idi Amin in Uganda. Look at Castro in Cuba. Somebody needs to go to Castro and say, sir, read history and quit. You're wasting your time. You're killing your country. Dictatorship doesn't work. Dictatorship is leadership from a heart full of pride instead of a heart of humility. Any person in authority ought to ask himself this question. Do I want to rule or do I want to lead? A dictator is a person with a big ego looking for a bunch of people who are gullible enough to feed it. I've seen people at different times who clamor for some position. I need a position. I'll tell you something. If a man will simply serve, are you listening to me? If a man will simply serve, position will find the man. And if he gets position and hasn't learned to serve, his position, frankly, will never amount to very much. Fathers, you can lead your homes in such a way that your wife and children will live in constant fear of you. A dictator in the home. There's a lot of fathers like that. But the time will come, I promise you, when you'll regret it. I'm thinking right now of a husband I counseled with several years ago now, whose wife had a pet dog. They also had some chickens. Bad combination. The dog killed a chicken. He got upset, but he let it go by. Then the dog killed another one. He got more upset. He said to his wife, this is his wife's little pet. Do y'all get this? I mean, did y'all hear that? I didn't say this was a mongrel dog that happened to wander off the street and they're kicking it out. This was the wife's little pet. Hello? You know what that's like? He said to her, your dog kills another chicken, I'm going to blow the dog away. And the dog did kill another chicken, and in anger, he walked out with his shotgun. And with his wife and children looking on, he blew away the family pet. Was he ruling his home? Certainly was. Does dictatorial leadership work? I think not. When I was counseling with him, I was trying to help him put his home back together. It didn't work. It blew apart. His wife took part of the children and left him. Wound up divorcing him and going with another man. I talked to you about sympathy leadership. I talked to you about dictatorial leadership. I haven't really talked to you about principles of leadership. I'd love to develop a whole message just talking about biblical principles of leadership. many principles you can find in the Bible that will make a leader effective. For instance, is everybody still listening? The leader needs to spend as much time as possible with those he's leading. He should be accessible. He should praise his followers. He must have self-control. He must listen. He must be decisive, but should first make sure he has all the facts. He should not drive the followers, but should lead. When possible, he should request rather than commanding. A leader must be organized. He must have a vision and communicate it. He should strive for excellence. Fellas, are y'all getting under conviction as bad as I am as I read this? He must be able and willing to stand alone. He should be forbearing, forgiving, friendly, and patient. He must be courageous and just. He should expect criticism and slander and not react with anger or vengeance. He must be character and truthful. He must not be a respecter of persons, but should treat everyone with respect. He must not seek honor, but instead must seek to humble himself. He must pass praise to others, but accept blame himself. He should not procrastinate. He should be accountable and hold others accountable while also being compassionate. And for all of those principles that I just gave you, I could easily take an hour and show you verse after verse and passage after passage and story after story in the Bible that teaches every one of those and many more. You know what? All of those principles fit like a glove with God's only biblical and proper style of leadership, a style of leadership I'm still trying to learn and hopefully you'll learn with me, and that is servant leadership. Say it with me, please. Servant leadership. No sympathy leadership is not right. No dictatorial leadership is not right. And servant leadership is right. What is it anyway? Well, let me explain it to you. Just after Jesus warned about the wrong leadership of the Gentile kings, pictured by the Gentile kings, then Jesus in Luke 22, 26 and 27 said this, "But ye shall not be so." You're not to be like those Gentile kings. "But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger. And he that is chief, as he that doth serve. For whether is greater, he that sitteth at meat, or he that serveth? Is not he that sitteth at meat?" But Jesus said, "I'm not like the one sitting being served. I am among you as he that serves." He said, the world thinks that the greatest person is the one who is being served. Jesus said, "I'm not like that. I am the one doing the serving." That is servant leadership. A servant leader looks to see what the needs of the people are and then works to meet their needs. It's what Jesus did for His disciples and people all around Him all the time He was here. They, the followers, are not there for the leaders. The leader is there for them. The followers are not there to serve the leader. The leader is there to serve the followers. And it doesn't matter what, if anything, he personally gets out of it. Sanders said this, quote, "True greatness, true leadership, is achieved not by reducing men to one service, but in giving oneself in selfless service to them." It is quite a contrast. If you at this point compare, we studied a while ago by King Saul, if you compare the leadership styles of David and Saul. One of the reasons that David was, quote, "a man after God's own heart" was because he was a servant leader. Acts 13:36 says, "For David, after he served his own generation by the will of God." After he served his own generation by the will of God, fell on sleep, was laid unto his father, saw corruption. But notice, what does the Bible say about him? He served his generation by the will of God. David thought of himself as a nobody and was willing, therefore, to help anybody. David's men served him. Why? Because he served them. Now, who was the greatest servant leader of all? You know his name? Jesus. You know what that means? Go back and think. Sympathy leadership is childish. Dictatorial leadership is caustic. And servant leadership is Christ-like. Philippians 2:7 says that Jesus made Himself of no reputation and took upon Him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. Made Himself of no reputation. He was God in the flesh. But He made Himself no reputation. Took upon Him the form of what? The form of a king? The form of a great somebody? He took upon Him the form of a servant. In Matthew 23:11, Jesus told His disciples, "He that is greatest among you shall be your servant." In John 13, verses 4 and 5, you have the picture that is really the picture of this whole message. Jesus shocked His disciples. It was just after the Passover meal. He riseth from supper and laid aside His garments and took a towel and girded Himself. After that, He poureth water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel wherewith He was girded. What an incredible picture. God in the flesh washing the dirty feet of His disciples. What is that? He was serving them. Now I want to ask you another question. Did those men, because Jesus served them, cease to respect Jesus? No. I got chills running up down my spine as I think of this. They respected Him more. He served them in many ways throughout His ministry with them for several years. He settled their disputes. He met their needs. He was God, but He wasn't too big to do anything that needed to be done. Now, don't misunderstand me here. Jesus, you know this is true, Jesus didn't always do everything they wanted Him to do. Some Jews wanted a Messiah who would continually multiply loaves and fishes so they wouldn't have to work, and Jesus wouldn't do it. I've had people come who wanted money or wanted a handout of some sort. And there have been times I help folks, but... And the next statement I'm about to make is not always true. But it's still an observation. My experience over almost 25 years of pastoring now is that the people who really need and deserve a handout the worst seldom let you know that they need it. Not always true. Not always true. And it doesn't bother me. If somebody in our church tonight, if you're hurting in some way, it doesn't bother me at all if you come and tell me, and we will help you. Most people in our country, this is not necessarily true in other countries, but it is much more true in our country. Most people in our country, because we've got welfare and food stamps, all these nets to catch people in need. Most people in our country who want a handout need counsel about how to handle their money worse than they need money. I've tried to give folks like that counsel. You know what? I've had them curse me to my face. I mean, call me, stood there and asked for money. And then when I said, yeah, I talked to them for a little while and saw the pack of cigarettes in their pocket and smelled the booze on their breath and ask them if they wanted to do some work and offered them some work and then found out they didn't want to do any work. And I said, well, I'm sorry, what you really need is counsel. I've had them turn and call me vile, filthy things, do everything but spit in my face and turn and walk out. Now, going back, the servant leader must lead in such a way that people's needs are met for leadership. Everybody has a need for leadership. Everybody at times has a need for encouragement. The servant leader must meet the need for encouragement. If you have someone under your care who needs encouraging, then the way you serve them is do whatever you need to do to encourage them. Older brothers and sisters, if you're going to learn the proper leadership as a servant leader for later in life, the reason you've got younger brothers and sisters is because God wants you to learn to serve them. It doesn't mean you always do for them everything they want you to do. It does mean that you do for them what they need you to do, and you're not too proud and haughty to do it. The needs for leadership, for encouragement, need for direction. a need for understanding truth. Don't ever mock somebody who is wanting to understand truth, whatever it is. A need for avoiding the pitfalls of life. People need direction, and the servant leader must lead people in such a way that he helps them avoid the pitfalls and so on. But the leader must not lead in such a way that he relieves people of their own God-given responsibilities. Toward the end of his ministry, Jesus would have been the greatest candidate to fall into the trap of sympathy leadership or dictatorial leadership of almost anyone who ever lived. But it's amazing to notice how Jesus never slipped or faltered in maintaining the strength of servant leadership. The Apostle Peter pulled out his sword and tried to force Jesus into a dictatorial position. Jesus told him to put up his sword and then said, "Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and He shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels?" Peter, that's not the way we're going to do it. Hours later, Jesus was standing before Pilate, who was supposed to be His judge. You remember that? Then saith Pilate unto Him, "Speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have power to crucify thee and have power to release thee?" Jesus answered, "Thou couldest have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin." Even on the cross, Jesus was telling John to take care of his mother Mary. He was continually serving others. Someone wrote this: "Multitudes followed Jesus. It was because He did not expect from them sympathy for His great sorrows. He comforted them in theirs." In 1 Corinthians 9:19, Paul said, "Yet have I made myself servant unto all, that I might gain the more." In 2 Corinthians 4:5, Paul said, "Ourselves your servants for Jesus' sake." Now, I'm not going to take time in this message to read the entire passage, but Luke chapter 17, verses 5 through 10, if you want to mark it and read it later, gives the marks of a servant. The first mark of a servant given in that passage is this: he is willing and ready to work hard to serve others. He is willing and ready to work hard to serve others. That's the mark of a servant. And a servant leader then is going to have the marks of a servant in his life. A story from the life of George Washington is a powerful illustration of this thought. It was a day when things were rather cold and bleak, and George Washington, starting out from his headquarters, threw on his great coat, turned up the collar, and pulled his hat down to shield his face from the biting wind. As he walked down the road to where his soldiers were at the time fortifying a camp, no one would have known that the tall, muffled figure was the Commander-in-Chief of the Army of the United States of America. As he came near the camp, he stopped to watch a small company of soldiers under the command of a corporal building a breastwork of logs. The men were tugging at a heavy log, and the corporal, important and superior, stood over at one side giving orders. The corporal cried, "Up with it! All together, push up with it, I say." The men gathered new strength, a great push. The log was nearly in its place on top, but it was too heavy. Just before it reached the top of the pile, it slipped and fell back to the ground. Corporal shouted again, "Up with it, up with it. What ails you? Up with it." And the men grabbed it and tugged and strained, and the log almost reached the top, slipped, and once again rolled again. "Heave hard this time," cried the corporal. "One, two, three, now push!" Another struggle, and then just as the log was about to roll back a third time, George Washington ran forward, pushed with all his strength, and the log rolled into place on top of that breastwork. The men, panting and perspiring, stopped to thank him. He didn't pay much attention to thanks. He turned and looked at the corporal. Remember, he had his coat over his uniform. He looked at the corporal and asked, "Why didn't you help your men with that heavy lifting when they needed another hand?" "Why didn't I?" asked the man. "Don't you see that I'm a corporal?" "Indeed," replied Washington, throwing open his great coat and showing his uniform, "I am only the Commander-in-Chief. The next time you have a log too heavy for your men to lift, send for me. I will help them." I found that story in that picture in a third grade reader in an antique store from 1897. It used to be that the children in schools in America heard that story. I'd never heard that story before a few months ago. How many of you, this was the first time you'd ever heard that story? I'm curious. Isn't that a phenomenal thing? See, they used that type story years ago to teach our children character. I know a man who accepted the pastorate of the church where he was raised. And the church had been in a downward spiral for quite some time before he came there. Of course, first thing that you think, if you know the Bible, is the prophet's going to have problems being honored in his own country. That's the church where he was raised. Here were the people who had taken care of him when he was a baby and all the jokes that go with that. He arrived at the church to be their pastor, set up a meeting with key leaders and teachers in the church, many of whom he had known most of his life. He looked at them in the meeting and he said, "You all know me already and know all my faults. I'm just here to help any way I can. Y'all have more sense you've forgotten than I'll ever know. Tell me what you think we need to do to get things rolling. Is there anything I can help you with?" They started coming to him with things they wanted and needed. Usher said, "I wish we had 3 matching offering plates." The nursery coordinator wanted an announcement made about people feeding their children before they dropped them off in the nursery. Somebody wanted carpet in their Sunday school classroom. Somebody wanted a chalkboard put up. One lady and her husband were the only ones who voted against the pastor coming, and he knew it. And she was sitting there as a teacher, and she asked for her classroom to be painted. Every one of those things were done by the next Sunday, and the preacher painted the classroom himself. And within a few days, the lady and her husband came and apologized to the preacher for their attitudes toward him coming. One man asked for his area of the church. It was a bigger area of the church, and several classes met there. Asked for it to be redone. New carpet, totally remodeling job, and it was going to cost several thousand dollars. And the preacher said, "Brother, you know the money just isn't there. You show me a way to do it, and we'll do it." Several months later, that man was helping with the demolition of an old house that belonged to the church on the church property. The man was driving a bobcat and lifting a load into a dumpster. They'd already loaded most all of it into the dumpster. He was lifting a load and he looked in the bucket of the bobcat and saw a $5 bill. He thought to himself, "This is my lucky day." He got off, walked over and looked closer, and it was even better than he thought. He discovered $4,400 in silver certificates, and they don't know how much had already gone to the dump. He called for the preacher. The preacher came out there. The man showed him, and immediately the preacher said, "There's the money to remodel your area of the church." In the 3.5 years that pastor has been there, they have now built a new auditorium. Attendance has tripled to 600 people. Offerings have quadrupled to $750,000 a year. And hundreds of people have been saved. They had 55 people saved this past week. Now, what am I saying? A servant is willing and ready to work hard to serve others. Secondly, a servant is willing to serve without praise or appreciation. Again, this is Luke 17, 5 through 10. Now, I'm not saying he should have to. I'm saying he doesn't live for it. He can keep going without it. He's very willing for others to get any credit. Luke 17, 9 gives the principle. Doth he thank that servant because he did the things that were commanded him? I trow not, or I think not. Third, a servant rejects pride and self-praise. Luke 17, 10 continues, "So likewise ye, when ye shall have done all those things which are commanded you, say, we're unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do." The servant leader should reject pride and self-praise. I love the next couple of stories. Waiting to board a plane on which he had a reservation, Brigadier General Theodore Roosevelt Jr. overheard the piteous plea of a private at the ticket window. I'm going overseas in 3 days, and I want to see my mother before I go. I can get home and back only if I travel by plane. It was explained to the private that every seat on the plane was taken. And just then, Brigadier General Theodore Roosevelt, Roosevelt Jr. Stepped forward and said, "I will surrender my seat to him." A fellow officer protested to the general. He said, "But sir, this is a matter of rank." And the general quickly replied, "That's right. He's a son. I'm only a general." That was a servant leader rejecting pride and position. Abraham Lincoln was known to stand on the balcony of the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. to salute the troops as they went off to war. One rainy day later in the war, he was drenched by rain as he saluted, and the soldiers enthusiastically cheered their commander-in-chief. When asked why he, the President of the United States, would stand out in the rain to do that, he replied, "If they can stand the rain, I guess I can." It's a servant leader rejecting pride and position. In 1 Kings 12 is the story of a man who lost much of his power as king simply because he refused to be a servant leader. You remember the story? Solomon had died. All Israel came to Shechem to make Rehoboam king. They appealed to Rehoboam to not be as harsh as his father had been. He said for them to come back in 3 days, he would give them an answer. The young king sought counsel from the old men who had learned much from life. Here was their counsel: "If thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day, and wilt serve them and answer them, give them attention, and speak good words to them, encourage them, inspire them, meet their emotional and spiritual needs, then they will be thy servants forever." Rehoboam didn't listen. He sought instead of the young men with whom he was raised. They didn't understand the principles of leadership, and they advised him to appear tough and harsh and to be a dictator. You remember what the old men said? "If thou wilt serve them." And 3 days later, when the people came back, the king answered the people roughly, saying, "My father made your yoke heavy. I will add to your yoke. My father also chastised you with whips. I will chastise you with scorpions." 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel rebelled, and the breach was never repaired. What are the four marks of leadership? The four marks of leadership of a servant, is that he is willing and ready to work hard to serve others. A servant is willing to serve without praise or appreciation. He rejects pride and self-praise. And fourthly, a servant is willing to give up rights and accept responsibilities. He's willing to give up rights and accept responsibilities. A group of boys were playing in the street. When a passerby asked why they were playing war, when a passerby asked them why they were all so quiet, not doing anything, one lad replied, "We're all generals and we can't get anyone to do the fighting." The servant must be willing to give up rights and accept responsibilities. A businessman who had 1,000 workers, this happened years ago, in his employ, was asked by a preacher, "How are you getting on with your men?" "Oh," he said, "I have no trouble." That was at a time when there was great trouble and turmoil in the labor markets. The preacher said, "You hadn't had any strikes?" "Oh, no," he said, "I never had any trouble." Preacher said, "What plan do you pursue?" The businessman said, "All my men know every year how matters stand. Every little while I call them together and say, 'Now boys, last year I made so much. This year I made less. So you see, I can't pay you as much as I did last year. Now I want to know what you think I ought to have as a percentage of this establishment and what wages I ought to give you. You know I put all my energy into this business. I've risked everything, put all my fortune into it. What do you really think I ought to have and what do you think you ought to have?'" By the time we come out of that consultation, we're unanimous. There's never been an exception. When we prosper, we all prosper together. And when we suffer, we all suffer together. And my men would die for me. How does a young man develop servant leadership abilities? Young men, listen to me. I'm almost done. Praise God that I see young men here who are already developing into servant leaders. That's exciting to see. How? They see a need and they feel it. They accept responsibility gladly without complaining and whining. They don't care what title or position they have. They're just glad for an opportunity to serve. especially? Are they sensitive to the needs of their moms and sisters and little brothers? How can you develop it? Be quick to open the door. Be diligent to carry packages, pick up trash, notice needs and opportunities. Ask, is there anything I can do to help? Don't run from responsibility, run to responsibility. I'm talking about becoming a leader, young men. Expect nothing from others. Expect no help and no praise. And don't whine and pout when things don't go your way. Stay calm in stressful situations. Accept the blame whenever you sin, fail, or mess up. People follow people who fail and admit it better than they follow someone who is too proud to admit it. Gladly follow others. You learn to lead by first being a good follower. The young man who can't follow dad and mom will have trouble later understanding why his wife and children can't follow him. You learn to lead by first being a good follower. One of the most disastrous and despicable attitudes I've ever seen in a young man is when he mocks some other young man for being kind to his mom and sisters. A scorner destroys his own potential for leadership. An advertisement at an automobile repair garage said this: "We will crawl under your car oftener and get ourselves dirtier than any of our competitors." That would be an outstanding philosophy for a young man to have toward life to become a true servant leader. I'll crawl around as much as I have to. I'll get as dirty as I need to. Just let me serve. You know, I suspect that garage had plenty of business, don't you? You remember the story we started with? A fella who was younger than almost anybody in the department. Unexperienced, underexperienced, no degrees, becoming the head of a group of over 20 engineers, many of them with doctor's degrees, all of them with master's degrees, and many of them with 20 years in their fields. Some of them had been with the company longer than that young man had been alive. He had a task ahead of him. He knew it. He sought the counsel of his pastor as to how to pull that group of men together and get them to do the job that was needed. And his pastor told him, use the servant leader approach. Humbly let them know that you feel like you're in over your head. Just tell them. His first day on the job, he called them all together and told them he had reviewed their credentials and that they were the most qualified group of individuals for the task before them he had ever seen. Note the praise. Praise is a magnet. He also told them he did not pretend to have any knowledge comparable to what they had, nor did he have a clue as to what needed to be done. Note the humility. He told them he was simply there to help them do their job and would be willing to do anything he could to assist them in the performance of their job. Note the servant attitude. As the men came to him with requests that formerly had gone unanswered, he gave them priority attention. And within weeks, the group had begun to perform better than they ever had. And the men who hired him said, yes, we did indeed hire the right man. Today, years later, that young man is one of the top officials in one of the top aeronautics companies in the entire world. I could give you his name and address. Obviously, we should not. The men who work for him still don't know that he never got a degree and that he never had any experience. He just learned to be a servant leader. Everyone is a follower. Everyone needs a leader. The greatest leader who ever lived is the Lord Jesus Christ. You're going to follow someone. Everybody does. Wouldn't you be wise to follow Jesus, the world's greatest leader? Praise God. Would you bow with me, please?